Anyway, welcome to all of you to the second week of summer school and to this course on the history of Western medicine. My name is Ingrid Fisk and I work at the Centre for Open Learning. It's a pleasure to introduce to you Professor Ian Aronson, though some of you, of course, heard him before when he gave a series of lectures at summer school on intersexuality. And some of you are colleagues of his and some of you are friends of his and some of you weren't bribed to be here. The large majority came of your own volition. Professor Aronson is a highly regarded, indeed a distinguished professor of urology and paediatrics. He's based at the Medical University of South Carolina in the United States, where he holds the chair in paediatric urology and is chairman of the North American Task Force on Intersexuality. Listed repeatedly in the listings of best doctors in America, he's been a visiting professor or guest lecturer at almost every key hospital or scientific meeting in the world that you could possibly name, and is a fellow or elected member of every important professional body in his field. In addition to these high-level professional achievements, Professor Aronson has special interests in the evolution of Western medicine, its origins, achievements, and the changing social contexts that have inhibited or advanced it. We look forward to hearing a person who can research and write on such focused and important topics as posterior urethral valves, as well as reflect on scientific discovery in the age of enlightenment. Please, would you welcome Professor Aronson.
Thank you so much. That's a lot to live up to. All I can say is I shall do my best. May I all thank you all for coming. It's a glorious day outside. And for you to be cooped up in a room with hammering drums above us any minute about to descend on us, I think that speaks enormously to your credit. I thank you very much for your indulgence. For this series of talks, we're going to be spending 5 evenings covering Western medicine from 3000 BC to the present time. Where are we? 2013. Things are moving at such a pace. And obviously that's a very tall order. And I've divided it up into 5 segments, as you know. And this evening, what I'd like to do, by way of introduction, is just to look at medicine as it evolved in Western medicine. This is, we're not going to be touching Oriental medicine, which is a completely different world. But for Western medicine, we're going to start with ancient Egypt. And Egypt is very much the precursor of Western medicine. You may question why Egypt in the context of Western medicine, but as you will see, I think it's highly relevant. I'd like us to imagine, if you would, it's obviously impossible in 50 minutes or so to span 3,500 years in detail and please be reassured I'm not going to do that. What I'd like you to do, though, is imagine yourself in a space shuttle going around planet Earth, but we will actually be in orbit, it's almost semi-stationary orbit, over Western Europe, Eastern Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and that's where we're going to be focusing ourselves. But this spaceship that we're in is somewhat different from conventional spaceships insofar as it's also a time capsule. So we're going to be travelling back in time as well as geographically going from place to place. So let's start then, if I can remember which button to press. There we go. Let's start 3,000 years ago as the new Stone Age in Europe was coming to an end. And Stone Age man was chipping away at his tools to hunt. In Egypt, at the same time, of course, there was a vast civilization reaching its zenith. The Egyptians were adept at, they had created great cities, great temples, great monuments, like these pyramids of Giza, 3,600 years BC. They erected great temples, such as Ramesses' Temple of Abu Simbel. Some of you may be fortunate enough to have visited that resurrected site above the Aswan Dam. Ramesses was a pretty astute pharaoh. He had created for him this temple right on the border of southern Egypt and Nubia. And the temple faced the Nubians, lest they had any doubt as to who was the boss north of the border. Now, for the Egyptians, we need to understand Egyptian medicine, we need to get into their mindset. And there's no better way of doing that than to go to the Valley of the Kings on the west bank of the Nile, as we can see here, opposite Karnak, the great temple. And there we can descend into some of the tombs that we opened. And as we do so, you'll see that we enter a mystical world of the Egyptian gods. And the Egyptian gods governed every aspect of Egyptian life. And these gods had to be cajoled and appeased in order that they would not only have a good life, free of illness, injury, disease, but also have a good afterlife. And who were these gods? Well, there were over 100 of them. And the most known, of course, was Osiris. You can see Osiris on the left-hand side there with his white crown and beard, the god who determined the fate of the underworld and the next life. And next to him is the jackal god Anubis, who was concerned with the fate of the soul. And next to him, of course, the all-seeing eye of Horus, the falcon-eyed god, who was the great protector. And these were the paramount gods who had to be appeased if you wanted to remain well. What do we know about ordinary Egyptians? Because when we talk about medicine, we need to think about the society in which this medicine was practiced, such as it was. We know most, of course, about the pharaohs because of their great tombs and sculptures and papyrus writings telling of the great deeds of the great pharaohs. But what of the ordinary people? Much more difficult to know very much about the ordinary people, but as you search, you do in fact build up a picture of Egyptian society. Most of the representation of the ordinary people are related to the court of the pharaoh and are often represented, as in this shard here that had come from a tomb of a pharaoh, indicating an illustration indicating a lyre player, one of the pharaoh's musicians. So we knew there were musicians, of course. In addition to musicians, of course, there were administrators and many other people related to the court. And if you were sufficiently wealthy, you might have a tomb commissioned prior to your death and have scenes painted in preparation. And here we see the tomb of a wealthy farmer. And you can see in this particular segment of the decoration of this tomb, the farmer is ploughing and his wife is sowing behind him. And here he is gathering, months later, his corn, and his wife is gathering it up in a basket. On another tomb, we find representation of fishermen on the Nile, or perhaps the Mediterranean, but more likely the Nile. And in the upper part of the screen, you can see a fisherman preparing his fish, cutting them and getting them ready for market. And also, the lowly washerwoman and washermen would be depicted. So already we're beginning to get an idea of the society that was there. And of course there were the soldiers and stonemasons and administrators and everybody else that was involved in running a sophisticated society, while Northern European man was still chipping away at his fence. Extraordinary. What dangers did the people face? Well, the Nile, of course, is the main lifeblood of Egypt. Those that have been to Egypt will know, and those that have seen NASA satellite photographs of Egypt will know that Egypt is essentially 99% desert, with a little ribbon of the Nile with a little bit of green on either side. So the Nile is what sustained the life of the Egyptians. And in the Nile were many dangers, one of which, of course, was the crocodile. And a crocodile is a reasonably sensible beast that will only attack you if he's hungry. But that's not true for the hippopotamus. And all you have to do is get in the way of the hippopotamus as to where he was going, and you would know all about it. So some of the ills that befell the Egyptians were related to attacks by crocodiles and the hippopotami. Stonemasons, of course, were very important in Egyptian society, if you think what was involved in making the pyramids, for example. And stonemasons were subject to injuries from their instruments and from crushing injuries from falls from rocks. In addition, of course, stonemasons worked essentially in the desert where there were scorpions and snakes. What do we know about disease? That's injury. What do we know about disease that might have befallen the Egyptians? And it's difficult to know. There's some evidence from papyri, some evidence from tomb paintings. And here is a remarkable example of a cella, a stone monument, depicting an Egyptian using a crutch, you can see, with a withered leg, which raises the question, did this man have polio? We can also learn about the diseases the Egyptians suffered by careful examination of the mummies. And here is the mummy of Ramesses V, and careful examination of his skin has revealed scars of smallpox. And when we examine the organs removed from the mummies, remember the mummy fires and remove the organs and put them in canopic jars, examination of the remains of the organs in the jars would reveal evidence of tuberculosis and the parasitic infestation from the Nile snail, Schistosomiasis. So already we can begin to build up a picture of the sort of afflictions that would have befallen Egyptians noble and humble. Extraordinary, this. This is a louse. I apologize for showing you a louse at 5:45 on Monday afternoon. But this is an electron micrograph taken from a hair of a mummy. So clearly, lice were present. And because of the proximity of Egyptians being essentially an agricultural community on either side of the Nile, outside of court, proximity with animals led to parasitic diseases. X-ray mummies also give some information. You can see evidence of fractures or arthritis. And interestingly, X-ray teeth reveals dental decay, but only in the most elevated of noble families, whereas those of the poor, such as evidence we have, their teeth were pristine. So clearly, sugar was something that was not good for you, and it was only the wealthy who could afford it. Water, of course, is the lifeblood of Egypt, as we've said. And water, therefore, had almost divine mystical quality. And in tombs, there are many artifacts left for the afterlife of the deceased, as you know, but among them will be a jar containing water. And here is an example in the Metropolitan Museum in New York of a jar with an inscription in hieroglyphic extolling the rejuvenative and curative powers of water. Highly revered. This is an amazing little thing. It's made of clay. It's only 5 inches, I have to convert that into centimeters for you, but 5 inches tall. And it's a bowl, which is tilted, with little human feet. And archaeologists have been scratching their heads as to what this represented. It's 3,600 BC, it's been dated to. And it is thought to be a water bowl to be put by the side of the deceased in the tomb, because the shape of the bowl and the legs are almost identical to the hieroglyphic for the word clean. Isn't that interesting? Now, amulets were terribly important to prevent disease. Water had this quality, but how do you actually prevent disease in addition to the use of water? And amulets were all pervasive. And perhaps the most widely used amulet was this model about 15 inches high, a limestone of the god Bes. I thought Bes was female, but Bes is actually very much male. The penis there has been removed, as you can see, but this is a male god, Bes, B-E-S, and carries in one hand a sword and the other hand a snake. And when we come to think of Asclepius and the staff and the serpent, one wonders whether this image is a precursor of that iconic state. Bes would have been placed in this form outside a house. Bes was, like Horus, a god of protection. And so Bes would have been placed outside the house to keep away evil. Childbirth, of course, was a very, very hazardous time throughout the millennia, particularly for the Egyptians, as you can imagine. And therefore, this god, Taramet, was very much in evidence, particularly related to childbirth. And this is made of glass, about about 6 inches high. A little spike on the head, presumably, is the base for a crown which has since been lost. But you can see she has the head of a hippopotamus, pendulous breasts, a big belly, and is holding the young sign protection. And this would have been placed at the bedside of a mother going into labour. And this is how you prevent postnatal sepsis, Egyptian style. This is a drinking bowl. Even babies require protection because, after all, neonatal mortality is high in any parts of the world today, and equally so, I'm sure, in Egypt. And this is a drinking bowl for a baby with a little opening you can see, with all the animals and dangers that might befall the baby on one side, and on the other side of the bowl is an image of Bess. Wands were used as well as a means of protection. And here we see a variety of wands with images of animals and hieroglyphics, and the hieroglyphics are of spells to prevent evil befalling. And these wands would have been placed in the crib of a baby, or a circle would have been drawn around the baby and the crib to keep away evil. And of course, the Eye of Horus was widely used as an amulet worn by women, and these are two examples in gold with the eye, as you can see there, from necklaces. So the general thinking was, these are the diseases that can befall us. The gods are clearly in command of everything, and therefore the gods have to be appeased by these gods acting as sentries around any site where danger may befall. Who were the doctors? Well, the doctors, not surprisingly, given the disease was thought to come from the gods, were the priests. For after all, it's the priests who were in the position to intercede with the gods. So it is not surprising that the physicians in ancient Egypt were in fact priests who recruited lay members to act as their assistants. And these, I suppose, we would call the true physicians, but the priest himself was the most important. And of those important physicians, perhaps, Amenhotep is perhaps the earliest known. He's the figure on the right-hand side with the crown, as you can see on the screen there, and coming to him for appeal is a mother with her two children. And this is taken from her tomb. So this is how you went to see your doctor in Egypt. If you were lucky enough, you actually went to see the top man who was Amenhotep, priest of the temple. Now, Amenhotep and his fellow priest physicians had a hotline not just to any god, but to this god, Sekhmet. And Sekhmet was actually the goddess, as you can see. She has a breast, a large abdomen, a head of a lion, and a wig such as worn by pharaohs, and the sun disc on her head indicating her power. And she was the goddess of calamity. And so it seems sensible, if everything emanated from Sekhmet, you went to the priest, you had a hotline to her. And that's how you avoided illness or obtained cure, at least to some extent. Amenhotep had a son called Yoni. And this is a small stone sculpture found in Amenhotep's tomb of Yoni himself here in the livery of a nobleman rather than a priest. And he has astride in his thighs a model of the temple of Osiris. So he is known as one of the earliest physicians after Amenhotep. But perhaps the most famous of all is Imhotep. Now Imhotep, this is a little 15-inch bronze representation of Imhotep, which is the only image which is known to us today. It's housed in the Louvre in Paris. And Imhotep was really the Leonardo da Vinci of ancient Egypt and the precursor of Hippocrates. And he is regarded as the first real physician after Amenhotep, who was more than just a physician. He was, first of all, the high priest of the Temple of Ra in Heliopolis. He was also chancellor to the pharaoh Joseph. And in addition to that, he had many other responsibilities. He was an architect and a builder, as well as in charge of the granary. It's a polymath, if ever there was. And it is to Imhotep that the actual structure of the famous step pyramid of Saqqara, which is regarded by art historians as the first example of cut stone sculpture in the ancient world, and Imhotep is credited with being the architect for this new concept of building. What did the Egyptians know about anatomy? Well, you would have thought that embalming and removing the organs to put in canopic jars, they should have been absolutely wizards at knowing all about anatomy. But surprisingly, the embalmers were of a completely different caste, so to speak, with very little communication, it would seem, with the priest physicians. So in spite of that knowledge of the internal organs, that never really got transmitted. Their knowledge of anatomy was really confined from papyri, as far as we can discern, to recognizing that the heart was the center of the body. But that is as far as it went. They also knew very little about physiology, but did know that there was a pulse to be felt at the wrist, which they called the heart talking. Isn't that lovely? They also knew, by the way, that pregnant woman's urine would cause barley to germinate rapidly, whereas that of a non-pregnant woman, the germination would be much slower. So they had little inklings in terms of physiology, but that was, seems, about as far as it went. What medicines did they have available? Well, most of them were botanicals. And this is from the tomb of Thutmosis III, his botanical garden, which he had while he was alive as a pharaoh, was represented on his, in his tomb. And many, many different botanicals are depicted, notably the lotus flower, for which the root was used apparently as an analgesic. But many other items were also used. They had, because Egyptians were spreading themselves geographically with their army, they were importing plants of different types, and it is said that many hundreds of plants were documented and widely used far and wide for alleged properties. They did recognize, however, the purgative effect of castor oil and of senna, which we use today. They also recognized, or claimed to recognize, the important medicinal effect of the pomegranate, which was held in great esteem by the Egyptian physicians. The pomegranate would either be applied to a wound or taken internally and was a curative, so they found. Honey was also widely used, and also some minerals, notably lapis lazuli, that very rare bright blue, deep blue stone, and no doubt because of its rarity it was thought to possess some sort of mystical power, and that would have been ground up and given to patients. Apart from those, there were some very exotic medicines that the Egyptians used, notably crocodile droppings, which were dried and placed in various mixtures with honey and various other things. Pig's brains were thought to be of benefit. And interestingly, ox liver was given for blindness. And we now come to recognize that liver is a rich source of vitamin A, and vitamin A is essential for the integrity of the retina. So not all to be seen. What about surgery? What do they know? What do we know about surgery? Well, here is a stone depicting surgical instruments, and you can see weapons of all sorts, scalpels, knives, forceps, even a balance there you can see in the middle on the right there for measuring things, and hot irons that were applied to amputations. So plenty of surgical instruments were available. And trepanning of the skull was widely practiced in Egypt, but so it had been for some 5,000 years previously, we know from archaeological digs. And in this particular example of the skull, you can see a large hole in the cranium there, and what is remarkable is that this patient or individual survived this procedure. And the evidence for that is the round, smooth edges of that hole, which would not have happened if the patient died. That represents reabsorption of fragments of bone and the laying down of a callus around the area. Why would they have done this? Well, if they did it because a stonemason got crushed in the head by a falling rock and developed a subdural hematoma. The ancient Egyptians would have been doing by making a hole and letting the blood out exactly the same as a neurosurgeon does today for the same problem. I suspect also, well, that this was done for epilepsy and various forms of mental disorder. Circumcision, of course, was also a wide practice. And although there was logic and experience that had been gained from all of these procedures, they didn't leave anything to chance. And by that I mean that they still had to invoke the gods, even though they were giving pharmaceuticals, so they thought, in their botanicals, or trepanning and doing other things, balancing oils, setting limbs, which we know they did. Here is a cella. It's part of the Metternich cella, which is a huge stone edifice some 12 feet high, covered in hieroglyphics with spells for this illness and that illness, and imploring the gods for this help and that help. And what the priest physicians would do to cover themselves, lest their pharmaceuticals were not as effective as they thought, they would pour over the cella water. The spell would then somehow be transmitted to the water, and the water would then be given to the patient. And so that way, everything was covered. What a lovely idea. The Egyptian physicians, for all the fun that we make of them with our sophisticated knowledge today, were in fact excellent clinicians, remarkable clinicians, so much so that an Egyptian physician was appointed to the king of the Hittites and the Persians. So they were highly regarded people, but we had no idea, no documentation really, as to justify that assessment, until in 1862, an American Egyptologist, Edwin Smith, in Luxor, went to an antiquarian and came across a dusty scroll, which was in fact 12 papyri. And he had no idea what he was buying, but he bought it and took it back to the States. And having done so, this was the outer part, and you can see why he probably bought it for a song, because it all looked as though the whole thing was disintegrated. But when the expert Egyptologists were able to remove the first outer layer, what was there to be discovered was amazing. Absolutely pristine papyri, written in Heretic, which is a cursive form of hieroglyphic. And when translated, it transpired that this so-called Edward Smith papyrus, which is what it's known as today, was 48 case histories of individual patients treated by a physician. We don't know who the physician was. The papyrus has been dated to 1500 BC, but it is almost certainly a copy of something that happened much earlier. But what was remarkable is what the physician said in this. You will note that the writing is both in black ink and in red ink. And each page of the papyrus is headed by the statement, "What I have gained by practical experience." Isn't that a beautiful thought? What I've gained by practical experience. And if we translate the red portions, these are the titles of each case history. And let me just translate that for you. I hasten to add, this is not my translation. The first heading is, "What happened?" Now ask any contemporary medical student, what's the first thing you do when you see a patient? You take a history. And here we are 5,000 years later, or 4,000 years later, they're taking a leaf out of the book of the author of the Edward Smith Papyrus. The next, there'll be a little bit of black there that actually describes what the patient said. And then the next bit of red on the page would be what I found. And what he found by looking, by touching, by smelling, by tasting the urine, by taking the pulse. Ask a contemporary medical student what you do after you take a history, you examine the patient. Oh, that a contemporary medical student would be as thorough as this, and I promise you they are not. Next, the explanation. What is the explanation? We would call that the diagnosis. And there it all is. Then the treatment. What which I did. And the mark of great wisdom, I think, is the prognosis and the conditions of all 48 cases. Within each case would end with the statement, there are certain conditions I can, this condition I can cure. Turn to another case, this condition I can help. And turn to another case, this is a condition for which I can do nothing. What wisdom, I ask you, isn't that just absolutely marvelous? But as we get into 800 BC, Egypt was in decline. Now we have the ascendancy of Greece. Was there a connection between Egypt and Greece? And I would suggest to you strongly, yes, there was. Greece didn't just rise out of the blue, certainly in the context of myths, and I'll illustrate that. The Greeks, of course, were unique for their philosophers, starting with Socrates, who asked the question, wanted to know the reason why, rather than just have an answer to the question. Followed by his pupil Plato, who started the first graduate school, if you like, the Academy of Athens. And then finally with Aristotle, who I think is going to be rightly regarded as the father of modern science, with his methodology of questioning and cause and effect and experimentation. So unlike the Egyptians, there was this whole new concept of philosophy causing men to think, and this of course had nothing to do with the gods. Yet, in ancient Greece, of course, the gods were very much alive and well. So here we have two conflicting streams of thought, the philosophers on one hand and traditional Greek mythology on the other. And who was the first god of medicine in Greece was, in fact, Apollo. Now, Apollo was one of the many, 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 many children of Zeus. And Apollo was taught his medical arts by the centaur Chiron, seen in this fresco. But Apollo was a very busy god, because he was god of music, he was god of poetry, he was god of the sun, and being god of medicine was simply too much for him, and he passed that on to his son, whom he had by the mortal, her name is facing for the moment, related to the sun, her name will come back to you, forgive me. His mother, therefore, was a mortal, and his son was therefore a demigod called Asclepius. And that's where Asclepius comes from. It's the god of a mortal and Apollo. And here is a representation of Asclepius holding a staff, and next to him, two of his six children were girls. One was called Hygieia, from which we have the word hygiene, and here she is sitting next to her father. The other was Panacea, from which we have the same word. Six and four sons as well. And interesting, we remember Bess, who had the sword and the serpent, and now here we have Asclepius with his staff and the serpent. And historians wonder where the serpent came from. Why the serpent? And the consensus seems to be, although there were dissenting opinions, that the serpent was let, non-venomous serpents were commonly let loose in the temples in Greece to keep away the rodents. They didn't harm humans, but they kept the temple clean and pure and safe. And that seems to be the most likely explanation for the serpent finding the staff, a staff just representing, presumably, authority or learning. And because Asclepius was therefore the god of medicine in ancient Egypt, it is not surprising that the priests of the temple of Asclepion, of Asclepius, would actually be the center where the sick would come for healing, in the same way we saw the Egyptians making an appeal to Amenhotep, who interceded with Sekhmet. So here we see people coming, and this is the remains of the Asclepium in Kos, an island of Greece, where a temple devoted to the cult of Asclepius. This was an Asclepion, and it is there that the priests would see the patients as they came, interceded as best they could, and by dint of experience, developed some skills of what was curable and what wasn't, so they picked up basic medicine just by trial and error, and also in turn trained a whole coterie of actual physicians who worked in the Asclepion. And among the trainees of the priests was the father of Hippocrates, and his son followed his father as a physician in the Scipio in Cos. And there's the great man himself, Hippocrates. And Hippocrates was unique in two main respects, a man to himself, apart from what he preceded. He was very concerned with the ethics of medicine, which had never really been vocalized or recorded before, and he wanted to remove medicine from the realm of the gods. And for proposing this, he actually spent time in prison for heresy by suggesting that disease did not come from God, but had a rational cause, because he was also a philosopher, schooled in logic. And so here you can see the tension now between religion and what we now call modern medicine. The Hippocratic Oath, of course, has come down to us over the generations in many modified forms, but in spite of the logic of Hippocrates and his denial of divine intervention as a cause of either disease or cure, notice the first paragraph of his oath in the oldest translation that I could find. He says, "I swear by Apollo the healer, by Asclepius, by health and all powers of healing, and call to witness all the gods and goddesses that I may keep this oath of promise to the best of my ability and judgment." So he couldn't escape his heritage. But whether that was to keep him out of jail for a second term, I don't know, but there it is. But then we get down to the meat, and look what an advance this was. "I will pay the same respect to my master in the sciences, to my parents, and share my life with him and pay all my debts to him. I will regard his sons as my brothers and teach them the science, if they desire to learn it, without fee or contract. I will use my power to help the sick to the best of my ability and judgment. I will abstain from harming or wronging any man by it. Do no harm. I will not give a fatal draught to anyone, even if asked, nor will I suggest any such thing. Neither will I give a woman means to procure an abortion. I will be chaste and religious in my life and in my practice. I will not cut, even for stone, but I will leave such breed procedures to practitioners of that craft." And this, unfortunately, set the scene for the great divide between physicians and surgeons. Surgeons were really there at the call of the physician right up until the beginning of the 19th century, when the Royal College of Surgeons in London was finally given a charter. So this all dates from Hippocrates. So as a surgeon, I'm a little bit annoyed that he put that in, but there it is. "Whenever I go into a house, I want to use my position to indulge in sexual contacts with the bodies of women or of men, whether they be free men or slaves. Whatever I see or hear professionally or privately, which ought not to be divulged, I will keep secret and tell no one. I therefore observe this oath. Do not violate it, and may I prosper in my life and my profession, earning good repute among all men for all time. If I transgress and forswear this oath, may my lot be otherwise." What a revolution. I would agree. I'm glad you feel the same way. The earliest example of the Hippocratic Oath, in fact, is from a Byzantine monastery, Christian monastery, in Constantinople, written in Greek in the form of the Christian cross, you will notice, but basically the same text. Now, Hippocrates was also very much influenced by the philosopher Empedocles. Empedocles was 40 or 50 years Hippocrates' senior, but had written. And Empedocles envisioned the body as being of two substances, one solid, the bones, the skin, the flesh, and the liquid. And the liquid he regarded as being for humans. And this is where, and Hippocrates embraced this concept of the humus. Because for Hippocrates, everything in life, according to the philosophers, was in balance. And so Empedocles' humus should also be in balance. What were those humours? This is from a medieval manuscript, but it illustrates it quite nicely. In the top right-hand quadrant, we have sanguine, which of course is blood. But below it, we have yellow bile. And next to that at the bottom, we have black bile. And above it, phlegm. And Empedocles thought that the body was in balance of these four humours, and that disease was, in fact, a ease and imbalance of these humours. Later people try to attribute personality traits to these. A sanguine person would be optimistic, a choleric would be angry and sometimes manic, one with too much black bile would be depressed, and morose was a phlegmatic person would be devoid of any emotion. And so these are an adornment. But because of this concept of imbalance, Hippocrates was very much drawn to a holistic view of medicine. And that if we could re-establish the balance, we didn't really need a lot of botanicals, ground up ox brain, and all this sort of stuff. So he very much downplayed that in his treatments. He was very much, therefore, the father of holistic medicine. And isn't it interesting how 2,000 years later we're coming back to the same way? What was known about the world at the time of ancient Greece? This is absolutely fascinating. I came across this. It's a map of the world as seen through Greek eyes in 400 BC. Of course, South Africa doesn't get a look in there, really. It's sort of lost in the Austral Sea there to be discovered. Very good detail, as you can see, around the Mediterranean. Greece, of course, Italy, all the Mediterranean islands, Anatolia, and the Middle East. But what went on north, where the Celts were, heaven only knows. And the Nile would seem to have its origin in Morocco, as we would now say, in the Atlas Mountains. But that's not a bad stab, given that oceanic exploration was still many, many centuries away. But of course, the great pioneer of expansion of Greek ideas was Alexander the Great, a Macedonian, who succeeded his father, Philip II of Macedonia. And he was the great militarist expander of Hellenic influence as far as the Himalayas on the east and as far as the Atlas Mountains on the right, towards where Morocco now is. And in addition, of course, having taken in under Hellenic influence the whole of North Africa, that led us to Alexandria. And Alexandria, of course, a town dedicated to Alexander the Great, was actually left in charge of one of his generals, Ptolemy. And it was Alexander's general Ptolemy who founded the Ptolemaic dynasty among the pharaohs of Egypt. And Ptolemy, having given lip service to his own king by creating the city of Alexandria, then pronounced himself king of Egypt. The great library of Alexandria was said to have contained 700,000 volumes. They were in the form of scrolls. You'll see somebody at the back there adjusting them on a ladder on the shelf there. And the great library itself was only one aspect of the greatness of Alexandria. The other was the first school of anatomy. And that was seminal in the advance of medicine and understanding of the human body. You'll recall how the priest physicians of Egypt had little idea of the body in spite of the farmers doing all their work. But the anatomy school in Alexandria allowed human dissection for the first time. And so now it was possible to try to make sense of the body, anatomically speaking, at least as one of the building blocks for understanding biological medicine as was to develop in the 18th and 19th centuries AD. What a huge time span. But there it was. The seeds were set with the anatomical school. And there was a famous physician, Erasistratus, who was very skilled, enjoyed a huge reputation as a great intellect, a great thinker, a philosopher in the Greek school, a great clinician as well. And he was one of the most highly regarded physicians of his time, having being the master of the anatomy school. He did dissection. He recognized the difference in the body between arteries and veins. What an advance that was. It could also be said, I think, and I think with some justification, that the ancient Greeks were the precursors of modern psychiatry. And that's a bold statement to make. And I make it on the evidence of this photograph, which is of a Dutch actor, photograph taken in 1896, playing the role of Oedipus, thank you. Exactly so. Up until the time of Sophocles and Euripides, Greek heroes were entirely at the hands of the gods as to what happened. You can think of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. The great heroic deeds were predetermined, if you will, by the gods. But with Sophocles and Euripides, for the first time, human emotion seemed to govern the fate of man. Now, the philosophers recognized the importance of the emotions, but felt that logic ought to override the emotions. But here we see, for the first time in Greek literature, the beginnings of emotion determining the fate of man. And I would submit that perhaps one could use that as an argument that here begins clinical psychiatry. A bold statement for you to take or leave, but I just put that up for thought. So the decline of Greece came quickly. The great philosophers, Homer, 800 BC, and by 200 BC, it was all over. Isn't that extraordinary? All that greatness, the philosophy, the democracy, the method of government, the aestheticism of the Greeks, a mere 600 years. Quite extraordinary. And by 200 BC, of course, Greece was virtually over, and it was the Romans who were on the expansion. Greek physicians knew where the money was, so they went to Rome, and Archagathus was one of the first Greek physicians to set up shop in the Forum, and there he dispensed pharmaceuticals, such as it was, plants, boils, and set bones, and was in fact the first Greek physician to be granted Roman citizenship. The Romans were interesting people. Unlike the Greeks, they were more militaristic in this sense. Human combat was something they valued very highly. Gladiatorial combat ranked very high in their entertainment and military expansion, of course. Unlike Alexander the Great, who colonized, I stand in deference to any historian in the audience, I'm sure there will be, but Alexander the Great wanted to extend Hellenic influence and culture. But the Romans, I suspect, were more interested simply in military conquest. And this at the zenith of the time of Hadrian in 117 AD shows the maximum limit of the Roman Empire, going right up to the most northern limit, as you can see in red, where England meets Scotland, and where Hadrian built his wall, on one side England, the other side Scotland. And because the legions were so far spread and needed to be serviced, it's not surprising that water was needed to be brought. And although we may belittle the Romans in the context of culture vis-à-vis Greece, we owe them an enormous debt as far as it comes to civil engineering, because they were the masters of building of the aqueduct. And where fresh water wasn't available, they built these magnificent architectural structures which carried clean water miles and miles and miles. They were not only concerned with clean water, they were concerned with sewage. And here we have, forgive me, a latrine situated on Hadrian's wall at one of the legionnaires' posts. Now, of course, it's decayed over 2,000 years, but let me, tasteless though it may be, reconstruct this latrine for you, because it shows the mindset of the civil engineers of ancient Rome. What we're looking at is a plinth of stone in the middle there, with a couple of things containing water, that's incidental. But there is free-flowing water running along either side of this plinth. And from the plinth to the outer wall, you can just see some stone slabs on either side, would be wooden planks. And the wooden plank would have a hole in it, and that's where the legionnaires would do what was necessary. And what was so brilliant, of course, this was completely separate from the clean water system that came for bathing and drinking, and this would be carried in a completely separate duct system out eventually to the open sea. If only in certain parts of the world that would apply now, infant mortality would be a fraction of what it is today. Bathing was, of course, as seminal to the Roman sense of cleanliness as it was for the ancient Egyptians. Baths came in all sorts of sizes, some grand, like the bath in the city of Bath in England, with hot rooms and cold rooms and various other rooms, or even a more modest one. Every town had its marble baths. A little mosaic from Herculaneum, for example, shows the services provided. So you didn't have to come with any equipment. They gave you some flip-flops, or whatever you would call them nowadays. They would give you loofahs and a special instrument for scraping off the calluses from your heel. Isn't that lovely? What about hospitals? What do we know about the beginning of hospitals? Well, I think we can say the beginning of hospitals started with the Romans. This is the Forum in Rome with Trajan's column there, as you can see. And if you look closely at the carving that goes around, the spirals around Trajan's column, you can see soldiers here receiving attention in a way station. You can see a soldier there attending to another soldier who's been injured, and others helping another wounded soldier come to the centre. Now, this is a way station for soldiers' casualty, not a hospital. But having said that, the Romans indeed did establish in their administrative buildings rooms that they set aside for dealing with the sick, called Medici, a little room off of the corridor. And one wonders if they got the idea from the time that the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 700 AD, where they had discovered way stations manned by the Jews to attend to pilgrims who were going to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And those way stations were really nothing more than hostels, but some were actually staffed by physicians. And so one wonders if the Romans got the idea from that. I don't know. But the downside, of course, for the next expansion was the bringing back of diseases and plague and various other things which would not have happened had the Romans stayed in Rome. So it was two-way traffic. Caesar was very good to physicians. So this is a scene, a romanticized scene depicting his assassination in the Senate. But before he was assassinated, he granted citizenship to all Greek physicians. In fact, all the physicians were Greek, even though they were now Roman citizens, technically. And he granted citizenship to all them, so respected was the medical cadre at the time. Yet there remained, apart from Roman influence, in what we now call Anatolia or Turkey, an enclave of Greeks where Hellenism thrived, albeit under allegiance to Rome. And there were three great men, Greek physicians, living under Roman aegis, who made contributions that lasted for millennia. And the first of these was Serranus. Serranus is held today to be the father of gynecology. And he came from the town of Ephesus on the westernmost part of Anatolia, facing Greece across the Aegean Sea. And this fanciful diagram of two women in labor in various positions belies the contribution he actually made. They're comical illustrations, of course. Here we can see on the right a fully mature woman with her feet about to present giving birth. So a complete nonsensical illustration. This is hundreds of years later from a book. But it does indicate that his teaching carried through for centuries and centuries and centuries. In fact, right up until the 16th century, Serranus' book on the diseases of women and childbirth was standard, the Bible for obstetrics and gynecology up until about 1500. Quite extraordinary. He's credited with developing the vaginal speculum, a birthing chair, and even a simple cotton plug contraceptive. So all of this was way ahead of what had happened in ancient Egypt, as I'm sure you understand. The second giant was Dioscorides, who was really a botanist become pharmacist, and he is regarded as the father of pharmacology. And he thrived, he came from the city of Cilicia, on the southernmost portion of Anatolia, opposite Crete, and he compiled a book that ran into four volumes for Serranus on diseases of women, five volumes for Dioscorides, where he recorded in meticulous detail 500 botanicals, which he thought had medicinal value. And his book was translated in many languages. Here's an original version, when I say original, a Greek version at least, with Arabic annotation, as you can see. And it was published in Arabic as well. 500 botanicals, of which, interestingly, 44 survived in the pharmacopoeia up until the 20th century, of which only 11 were subsequently found to have any therapeutic benefit. So isn't that sad, all that hard work? But that was the diligence with which he approach to his subject. And indeed, we'll just go back one, indeed, this book of Dioscorides' Pharmacopoeia first appeared in English in 1655 and went on being reprinted, can you believe, until 1934. Such was the sway of this great man. But the greatest of all, of course, was Galen, Claudius Galanus, in Latin, Galen as we know him today, who was born in the city of Pergamon, which was the intellectual powerhouse of Hellenism under the Roman Empire. It was left almost autonomous. The legionnaires patrolled and were responsible militarily for its security, but for all practical purposes, it was a continuation of ancient Greece. And there, Galen learnt his craft. He is on the left-hand side there in an abbey, a fresco that appears there. Galen learnt his trade in the Asclepium in Pergamon. Every city, you remember, in ancient Greece had its own Asclepium, a temple to Asclepius, physicians and priests and lay physicians saw the sick and learned by default how to treat. And Galen led his apprenticeship as a physician there, but he was much more than that. He was a great intellect, and he was extremely learned and revered in his time to the point, and also a great physician, to the point that he was appointed as physician to Emperor Marcus Aurelius at the age of 33. An extraordinary man. And he perpetuated the teachings of Hippocrates, again wanted to remove illness and medicine from the gods, and it is said of Galen that he plucked illness from the heavens and brought it down to earth, for which Hippocrates was jealous. But here he is, some 400 years later, being able to say that with more confidence. He was also a very acerbic personality and would have no truck with anybody who disagreed with him, and he wrote copiously many, many works and contributed enormously. He also spent 4 years in Alexandria at the anatomy school, and so he was able to carry on the work of Erasistratus, and he went further than Erasistratus, not only in recognizing from his anatomical dissections the differences between arteries and veins, but recognized that blood could be red blood or blue blood. And he had a curious concept, almost of circulation before Harvey, as we'll be discussing on Wednesday. His concept was that blood was made in the liver and then passed into the right side of the heart, which indeed it does, but then mystically passed through the septa separating the left and right ventricle through pores, which he claimed to be present, which of course we never see because they don't exist, ignoring the pulmonary circulation entirely. And then mystically, the blood became red as a result of pneuma. Well, pneuma is something to do with air, so he must have been onto the lung somehow, but bypassed the pulmonary circulation. So this comes to Galen's concept of circulation. Blood is made in the liver, passes to the right side of the heart through mystical pores to the left side of the heart, and then through the arterial circulation to permeate throughout the body where the blood is absorbed. And that's as far as he got. Well, we laugh now, but given where he was coming from, phenomenal advance. He was a wise man and a great philosopher, and perpetuated the Hippocratic principle of cosmic medicine and eschewed pharmaceuticals as far as he could. He's revered today. Here is a statue of Galen in the medical school in Bologna, and his statue appears in many of the medical schools. And so the Galenic tradition is a perpetuation of Hippocrates, but Hippocrates himself, I think, was not far removed in his approach to the order of the Edward Smith Papyrus and the priest physicians of ancient Egypt. So I present to you this broad overview, which of course is a gross oversimplification, with very little amplification on many, many other individuals who contributed. But I hope it's given you a flavour for where we were in 500.